Hello, Bulldogs. Thank you for tuning in to Who's Behind the Bulldog, Arvada High School's community interview podcast series. I'm your host and one of the assistant principals at Arvada, Jeremy Jensen. Each week, I'll sit down with someone from our Arvada community, be it staff, students, families, or other community members, to hear their stories. We'll discuss their histories, successes, challenges, learnings, future hopes and dreams, and much more. I hope you find some connections in their stories and hopefully are inspired to take some time to get to know them a bit better as our school year progresses. We have an amazing community here at Arvada, and I hope we can continue to strengthen that despite the challenges that await us in these unknown times. Today's interview is with Sergio Yanis. Sergio is going into his fourth year at Arvada as a CTE teacher. This year, he is scheduled to teach Communication and Journalism, Intro to Teaching, AP Lang, Photojournalism, and Sports Broadcasting. He's also a yearbook editor, for which he has won multiple awards. In our conversation, Sergio opens up about his experiences as a student of color in a predominantly white school in Florida, and how this influenced both his decision to become a teacher and how he teaches. He talks in detail about personal and professional connections to Arvada's big focus for the year, equity. Sergio, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
How are you doing today?
A little tired. We're getting ready to start the school year, however that may look. And so there's a lot of decisions, a lot of information being thrown at us. But otherwise, I'm doing great.
Good. Sergio, tell everyone what brought you to education.
It's kind of like I was always supposed to be here. I was definitely that kid. I remember being 5 and 6 years old and people asking me what I wanted to be, and my only two answers every single time were I wanted to be a writer and I wanted to be a teacher. And so the writing thing became just kind of more of a hobby, and then the teaching was that one consistent thing in my mind. And I didn't really know why I wanted to be a teacher. I just did. I just felt that need. And it didn't make sense until I started going, or, you know, had my experiences in high school about, and started really, like, you know, as you're in your formative years and you start noticing, like, oh, this is what the world is like, or this is, you know, these are some systems at play. And then I learned more about them as I went through college, and had some very different experiences leaving home and being in a place that was vastly different socially from what I grew up in. And it really combined to kind of formulate what it was that was the draw for teaching for me. And it's always been for me about giving students the opportunity to be better than where they are right now, and showing them that they are capable of more. And every single experience that I've had going through school, and I've had a lot of fortunate circumstances and a lot of advantages going through school, they just brought me to that, because even going through those advantageous experiences, I did notice that it wasn't the same experience for everybody. And that was just something that really stuck out to me as to why different people had different experiences in education. Not in the sense that they were learning different things, but just how they navigated the world of education, or how the world of education interacted with them and who they were and where they were in life. There were some moments where it wasn't fair, or they weren't given chances. And so I remember, especially going through high school and college, looking at people around me who are incredibly capable and thinking, well, why aren't they here? What's keeping them from being where I am? And yeah, so that was a really roundabout way to kind of explain what landed me here. But it really is a perfect storm. And as years have gone on, I have found more and more things that, or more and more ways that I can attack those or help out in those places where there are deficiencies, or where people aren't getting what they need, and bring them those opportunities.
Do you have any specific examples from your experiences?
Oh, geez. Well, okay, so growing up, I grew up in Miami, which is a pretty, Latino culture. Everywhere you go, signs are in Spanish, there's Latin, social norms are based on, Cuban, Caribbean, Latin American norms and expectations, the idea of family. People just kind of get it. And going through high school, doesn't traditional American high school doesn't really fit some of those expectations from Latino culture or some of the worldviews from Latino culture. And so there was a little bit of cognitive dissonance there where there was this huge expectation to look out for only yourself, especially being a part of an IB program. Where it's very much looking out for yourself and being responsible for your own work, which is great. Those are great ideals. But there are moments where, Latin American culture kind of has more collectivist ideals, and there's a little bit of jarring there. So I think that's where I started to kind of notice that there were some things amiss. And then there was a huge eye-opening moment when I went to college, actually when I left college and got my first teaching job in Tallahassee, Florida. It was there where I really experienced that people don't inherently know about Latino culture or, or about people of color in general. They just, it's a predominantly white world. And I think that's where I really, that's where I realized it, because one of the first questions that I was asked when I joined the faculty was, why don't I have a Mexican accent? Which was kind of eye-opening because I'm not Mexican. And it didn't dawn on me that people just had minimal experience with people of color. And yeah, so it was that point in my life was interesting because it was where I realized that Miami was a very specific experience for me. And I really didn't, and I took a lot of things for granted because I didn't grow up with a lot of the overt pressures from a system that tends to marginalize people. And I went into an environment where I really did become the other, the novelty, the token. And that's when I really started to see as an adult that, it's not just me, it's students going up through this system, live in this system that is constantly marginalizing them and telling them that they're different in one way or another, and that those differences shape their experiences and how they're supposed to move through the world. Yeah, so I think those are two of the biggest, or those were the big moments.
So your worldview changed significantly during this move. Where was there a moment, or was there something that happened that you were like, I want to become a teacher because of this experience that you went through?
I attribute that a lot to teenage rebellion, more so. There were moments in high school where teachers were, in my opinion, as a rebellious teenager, quote unquote rebellious, were being less than fair. And I remember experiences in high school, whether it be academically, like I remember writing an essay one time for history that was satirical, and the history teacher didn't appreciate it, and penalized me for that and called home and said that I was, not taking the class seriously, and because I wasn't just compliant and writing the essay that he was expecting to be written. Some other things, in marching band, being looked over for different positions in band, because I didn't have the financial backing to necessarily help. It was very clear in that kind of structure that that's what they were looking for with some of their leadership. Similar experience. So it was little experiences there that kind of triggered this pushback that I had to say, well, I can definitely do that better. And it wasn't necessarily like, ah, that's why I want to be a teacher. It was more of, when I'm a teacher, I know that I'm not going to do these things, that I'm going to do these things instead.
So what are you doing instead?
A lot of it really comes down to listening. One of the biggest problems that I had going through school in general was people not necessarily taking the time to understand where I was coming from or why I thought certain things or where my mind was even wandering off to. For certain, you know, during lessons or for, you know, in projects or when we were supposed to be working by ourselves. And so when I'm in the classroom, one of the first things that I do remember to, like, I do remind myself to do is to figure out where is a student coming from? Because it's not my place. When a student comes to me, they're not coming to me in a vacuum, perfect package, and I unwrap them and nothing has affected them in their life. They bring with them everything that they've experienced up until that point, the good, the bad, the ugly, the pretty, all that. And it doesn't always have to look like a heart-to-heart or sit down and have coffee with the student and figure it out. Sometimes it's literally observing from afar, seeing how they interact with other people and putting pieces together. Mm-hmm. It's noticing those moments where things do seem to be going well for them and trying to figure out and deconstruct, well, how can I, what is making that a positive experience and how can I bring some elements of that into my personal interactions and also the interactions that the student has in the classroom. So listening and paying attention is a huge part of it. The other one is understanding that life continues, and that life happens. I grew up in a culture where when I was in school, that's all you focused on. Nothing happens outside of school. I wasn't allowed to get a job, which, my mom sacrificed a lot in order to make that happen. It wasn't an easy thing by any means, but she made that a priority where school was my job. Because I was observant as a child, I noticed that a lot of people didn't have that advantage and didn't have that situation. And it wasn't necessarily a right versus wrong thing for me. It was an objective observation of this is reality. And I feel lucky that I was able to put those pieces together and notice that that element does impact students. In terms of, they go home to certain things, they bring from home certain things, conversations, events, daily lifestyles, all those contribute to how a student understands the world, and how a student experiences education is based on how they understand the world at that moment. So,
how did you get to that point where these are the priorities, the things that you know are making the difference? Because you started off in Florida, teaching in Tallahassee area, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've been in education for how long?
Starting my 15th year, so I just finished 14 years.
And you've been in Colorado just for the past, what, 3 or 4 years?
4 years.
4 years. So tell us a little bit about your journey to kind of become the teacher that you have become.
Yeah. I had great mentors and models to base myself off of. When I was going through high school and really starting to figure out what kind of teacher, what area of teaching I was going to go, I initially thought I was going to be a music teacher because I had had such positive experiences in the field of music. I had taken it from middle school and through high school. And when I enrolled in college, I was a music education major. I didn't want to go into performance. I want to stay in education. But I had great models of what good music educators do. And I had other models in other areas, foreign language teachers who were great for different reasons. Some were incredibly compassionate. Some were incredibly good at figuring out what it was that maintained my curiosity and how to challenge me in that. And I took bits and pieces of those with me to college, and it was very much a subconscious thing. I didn't know that I was doing it until I was sitting in my professor's office, I think my last semester before my internship. So this would have been senior year, my first semester of senior year. And she's handing me back a paper with a B, and I'm arguing with her because we're going through the rubric, and she said, listen, what it comes down to is I know that this, you know, would tick off all the A markers of a rubric, but this is not your A work. And it was, I don't know, it was weird because it was at that moment that I hit that epiphany of like, oh yeah, she's not the only one who has shown that. There was this teacher, there was this teacher, there was this teacher, and there was this teacher. So it was, I think, then that I really figured out, okay, when I'm a teacher, that's one of the things that I really want to focus on, is every student will have different, what I term then, A work. And then I got out into the classroom for a full-time internship, and that's when I started putting all those things into practice. And I was paired with an amazing teacher, my mentor teacher, who became basically my mom away from mom back then. And the very first thing that she said really, really struck a chord with me when we were sitting down and talking about how the internship was going to go. She said, no matter what, remember that you're always teaching somebody's baby. And it was, I mean, it makes, on a literal level, that makes sense, because obviously the children, you know, are coming through the classroom. But, you know, even though I wasn't a parent then and I'm still not a parent now, it helped me understand that what I do in a classroom does impact a student, but I also have to see outside of myself and see beyond that what I do also impacts, you know, the family and how the parents interact with their students, the guardians, the caretakers. And so when I started, it was from that place of compassion. And I will say my first year of teaching was an interesting one, because I realized that I can't be exactly like my mentor teacher was. She had a huge heart. She was incredibly motivational. And she showed a lot of love for the students. And I remember trying some of the things that she did in the classroom my first year, and those things completely bombing. And when I sat down and realized what was going on there, or thinking about what was going on there, what stuck out to me was the personality piece. She had, and it was then that I realized that your personality and who you are as a person, you have to be your authentic self when you're in front of your students. You can't try to be other people or try to mimic what you have seen other people do. Unless you have to translate what they do into who you are in your psyche. Mm-hmm. I am not somebody who's inherently emotive or affectionate, who's incredibly encouraging in the sense of cheerleader style, where, you know, they're constantly rooting. I realized that my brand of encouragement does lie in a more serious tone, does lie in other ways of pushing and challenging and questioning students than what I have seen other teachers do. And so those big lessons have were kind of those eye-opening moments, and that's where I really started to make teaching my own, instead of just something that I am trying to mirror from what I have seen, or trying to replicate from what I have seen done. And so, I mean, so on a professional level, those were those big moments. On a personal level, a lot of my experiences, even with other adults, shaped a lot of what I do in the classroom. Because, like I said, when I started teaching in Tallahassee, or started living in Tallahassee, I realized the world was very different from what I grew up in Miami. Moving to the closest thing that I can equate it to is Zora Neale Hurston's story, How It Feels to Be Colored Me. And in there, she talks about how she grew up in kind of an insular community. And she describes her first experiences with actually realizing that she was a Black person. And it was a kind of a parallel experience for me, being in Tallahassee and realizing, like, oh, I am the brown guy. I am the brown teacher, because people looked at it completely differently from what I was used to when I was growing up. And my experiences with other teachers, including, questioning, do I speak Spanish? What part of Mexico my family's from? All those little microaggressions just came flying at me. Mm-hmm. And it was just really interesting trying to navigate that kind of world that I was sheltered from for a greater part of 18, 19 years of my life. So I didn't have the practice building up to it. And then trying to maintain, honestly, a sense of dignity and grace around it all when I'm confronted by, when I'm in front of a lot of students. There was my first year of teaching was very trying in that social circumstance because I had to navigate a world that my students were also navigating at the same time, being in very similar places in our development, socially speaking. And while I taught in a predominantly white school, I can count on fingers and toes the students of color that I taught every single year. It was really interesting navigating a mental space where, okay, in these conversations and these circumstances, I am someone who is outside of a norm. I am someone who is an other. I am someone who is, in some senses, less than. They're less, I'm expected to know less than I do. I'm expected to not be as smart as I am, or as capable as I am, or to understand things because I'm an outsider. And then having to turn around and be in front of students and be the person who knows the most, be the person who, because that was very much an expectation, when, especially at the school that I was teaching at, was, the teacher knows the most, the teacher is the expert in the classroom. It's why I'm having a lot of trouble still kind of describing what that experience was like, because it was so jarring being less than and being expected to be more than at the same time.
How do you think that's impacted you?
I still have a little bit of residual trauma that I didn't realize was trauma. Around it, when I encounter, especially when I encounter moments, experiences, conversations, whether or not I'm involved, I could just clearly overhear them. And those moments, if I'm, it's hard to, it's really hard to, especially as time goes on, let more and more of that slide, because now that I'm aware of exactly what was happening, because I'll be completely honest, you know, 21-year-old me, my first year of teaching, didn't understand what was happening. And it's not something that I understood until year seven, for example, of being at that same school and being in that same, environment. But it's, while it is angering and while I want to say a lot of things, it causes me to shut down a lot of times, which is not the healthiest way of dealing with it, and I fully take that on because I want to show my students that they deserve better than what they currently have, and I keep repeating that, but then it's hard for me at times to live up to that, because I know that I deserve to be treated better. I know that I deserve to be thought of as in better lights when I encounter situations that are diminishing like that. And so, to be perfectly honest, it does feel a tad bit hypocritical at times that here I am, you know, empowering my students to the best of my ability, but I can't even empower myself sometimes to speak up against a lot of the things that I encounter or see when I do encounter them. So,
what do you wish would be different right now?
Oh man, a lot. I wish people would be more aware of the residual consequences of the things they think, the things they say. And I wish people would be more critical of, or at least would examine more deeply why they think the things that they do. Because even things that are seemingly innocuous to you, to your group of friends, to the people you associate with on a regular basis, may not be received well in other circumstances, other social circles, other environments. And especially since we are such dynamic beings as humans, I think people need to know why they're adjusting, why they have to adjust to the circumstances that they're in, as well as how that impacts who they are, the people that they interact with in various spaces. Yeah, so there's that. And I mean, on a more real level, on a more, you know, physical, down-to-earth kind of level, I wish people wouldn't diminish other human beings simply because of internal biases or because of flash perceptions. So,
do you think that this world is improving in that area?
It's really hard to say. I will say one improvement is we are talking about it a lot more now than we have in the past. And in that sense, I think there is improvement. What we're seeing as a result of that now is people falling back on, well, back in the day, this didn't happen, or this wasn't as big a deal, you know, back when, or a couple of years ago, or whenever, and which is aggravating because they don't realize that the reason they didn't see that back then, or whenever they're saying, is because people didn't talk about it. You know, there were still all these oppressive elements at play. We just, nobody had the gumption to stand up and say, hey, that's wrong. So I will say there is improvement in the fact that we're letting a lot fewer things slide, and it's forcing us to have more conversations where we examine who we are, where, what it is that makes us think the things that we do, and what the repercussions of those thoughts and actions are.
How do you think that we can get better at all of those things?
I think there's a certain humility in all of it, that's required in all of it. No one likes being told that they're wrong. No one likes being told that that there are negative implications to the things that they think or do, or negative real physical consequences to the things that they think or do. I think we have to humbly remind ourselves that the reason somebody is mentioning that something is wrong is because they want something to get better, not necessarily intending to personally attack us. And so it's, you know, and I don't know where that thinking came from. Probably from you know, school experiences where being told you were wrong was almost fatal in some cases, metaphorically speaking. But yeah, I think being able to understand that if somebody says that something that we think or do is wrong, we need to sit down and think, okay, if they're saying that's wrong, what's causing them to say that? What could I possibly be doing to get that reaction from them? Is there a communication breakdown? Because they're not necessarily saying that I'm a bad person. If somebody wanted to say that I was a bad person, they could just tell me I'm a bad person. So yeah, I think it's moving beyond the personal attack kind of space.
What's next for you personally? What's a goal, something that you want to grow in, get better at?
I want to get better at having those tough conversations, even with my own students. It's not that I necessarily avoid conflict. It's that sometimes I do catch myself kind of softening the blow, or what, you know, I'm intending to say, I kind of warp it a little bit so that it doesn't sound, or so that I don't perceive it as sounding as harsh. I do that because I want to come off as still that kind of sympathetic, understanding person, and I need to basically teach myself and convince myself that I can still be direct in you know, having these tough conversations without diminishing the message, and without being harsh about it. So I think it's being better at communicating with students, and having those tough conversations when they need to be had.
It's a really hard thing to do.
It really is. Especially when, you know, because teachers, we're these supposed developmental experts, right? So we know that, a student is thinking this way because of X, Y, and Z. You know, this is logical to a teenager who's, in my opinion, clinically insane. You know?
Dr. Giannis.
Right? But it's, you know, if I understand where a student's action is coming from because of, you know, what's happening either developmentally, cognitively, or just life-wise, that doesn't mean that I should necessarily, over-adjust, I think is what I'll call it, in trying to correct that. You know, there's a lot of things that I want to get better at, but I think that's one thing.
I've really gone off script here today. I haven't asked you some of these usual questions, but
please do.
I want to ask about your best failure.
Oh man, every day is a failure in my opinion. In the most positive way possible. But let's see, my best failure. Man, there are so many good ones. Most of them are funny. I'm gonna have to sit on that one for a second.
Okay. Let's talk then about what are you most proud of here at Arvada? What would you say in the 4 years that you've been here have been maybe the one or two most biggest accomplishments that you've had?
The biggest personal accomplishment for me so far has been to build a journalism program, and it's still growing. It's still in its building phases, but having something that basically sustains itself at this point has been great. It was actually one of my stipulations for taking this job when I interviewed. I interviewed for an English position. And I was very clear in what I thought was a demand, but people have told me I was a lot nicer about it than demanding it. I made it very clear that I wanted to move beyond being an English teacher to being a full-time journalism teacher. One of the things that I really 1,000,000% fell in love with in Florida was becoming a yearbook advisor and seeing how the things that I was teaching in English class, language-wise, were playing with the elements of graphic design, which is another side passion of mine, and visual photography, and combining to create this incredible product, which is something that English classes don't typically get to do. You don't typically walk out of English class with like, all right, here's a year's worth of my, cold hard work, other than here's a collection of essays or maybe a couple of creative projects that you would do. And building something that does build or that does accomplish a complete purpose that takes not just one person, it takes a lot of different people to put together. And so seeing how that went in Florida, I really wanted to go even beyond that and do more with it. So it was one of the things that I asked for here was to move to a place where I could be a full-time journalism teacher. And while it's not a full-time journalism program, the other classes that I am teaching are also incredible. And hopefully we're building towards something where I am a full-time journalism teacher. But yeah, I think that's one of the many things I'm proud of here is building that program and making that dream a reality for myself is really cool.
That's such a great program.
Thank you.
You've done a really fantastic job with it, honestly.
Thank you.
Best failure. So thinking about the things that you thought maybe at the time were big mistakes or something that you just tried and failed, but looking back, you're like, I'm so glad that happened.
So this one's not a funny one, but this one is really crucial in getting me to where I am today. My second to last year at my previous school, there was in the yearbook, the students had chosen to include a profile in first person narrative form, so the students' own words, about that student coming out. Unbeknownst to the yearbook staff at that point, when they interviewed him, he was not out to his family outside of school. And we didn't realize that until the yearbook came out. And so there was backlash from the family. They called the school. They couldn't believe that this had happened, everything like that. So I got called into the principal's office about why did I include this in the yearbook and everything. And it became a really frustrating conversation where my stance was the students were within their rights to print something in their yearbook because that was the responsibility of the yearbook staff. That had been what they had been tasked with is making sure that they tell the best stories possible, and they felt that that was the best story possible. And they did their jobs as reporters. They did all the right things. Yes, there was some social backlash, but they took a risk, and they knew what could come from that risk. Unfortunately, the other side of that argument, the administration, did not agree with that. They did not agree that the students had the right to include that in the yearbook, that it was causing undue stress on the family. And I kept arguing and arguing the point. And at one point, the assistant principal had said, "Well, you don't know what it's like because you don't have children." And at that point, I hit such a dead stop. Nothing that would have come out of my mouth after that would have been anywhere near productive, let alone civil. Because it was an immediate confrontation with, you know, an attack that I didn't have children, so I will never know what it's like to be a parent. An attack on, on being a gay male and not knowing what it's like to come out to your family, and how a family can react, and that social dynamic. It was just such a tone deaf statement to say. And I count it as a failure because I could not move past that moment. And all I could do was stand up and walk out of the room. But what came after that was this opportunity to move out here, be a part of an environment where I do feel supported in what I do, where I feel like my students are supported in what they do, where people understand where I'm coming from. And if they don't, they at least try to understand, make an attempt to understand where I'm coming from. And so that failure to successfully defend my students led me to a much better situation. Professionally, where I feel like I am thriving better.
That's quite the story.
there is a lot more to say about. I mean, there's a lot more to say about that after the after effects, because there was some perceived retaliation as well after that. But those are a lot more personal things, I guess.
Well, thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Sergio, if you could offer one piece of advice to other educators out there, what would you say would be that one biggest piece of advice that you could offer to them?
I'm going to stick to what my mentor told me. Remember that you're teaching somebody's baby. And, at the end of the day, humans are humans, and they deserve to be treated as such.
It's awesome that your mentor's words are living on and coming back full circle. Yeah. Sergio, our students are extremely lucky to have you in their lives, and they deserve to have educators like you who have such a huge ability to be empathetic and to build relationships with them and to figure them out in ways that, you know, other people aren't able to. So thank you so much for your time here today, and hopefully we have a really excellent year.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you all for tuning into today's podcast. I want to encourage you to take a minute to reach out to today's guest and make a personal connection. Until next time, this has been Jeremy Jensen with Who's Behind the Bulldog.